This podcast contains intense subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
So you remember finding the remains?
Yeah, it was actually, I was with my dad when, because I was only eight. I was surprised how much I could remember, you know, because I came up here in May to make sure, I knew what I was talking about and I could remember it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so it was pretty easy to find. The campsite, and I went up there and walked around, and I think I got real close to where the grave was.
Yeah.
From the pages of the Reporter's Notebook. This is Still, Season 2. I'm your host, Gary Anderson. We're deep into the foothills of the Blue Mountains in eastern Oregon.
Everybody brought a camp trailer. I remember that. And one family was camped over there. I think we were camped pretty much in front of my truck, and then there was another camper down there.
My colleagues and I caravaned up here with the group. All told, there were a dozen of us, plus a few dogs. Before we arrived at this spot, we all rendezvoused in the nearest town.
Okay, hey, Mel.
Somerville, Oregon, population 144.
Okay, that's I'm like, I recognize the faces.
Gary and Christine.
Nice to meet you guys.
The town is about 10 miles southeast of where an unidentified woman's remains were found by hunters in late August of 1978.
Oh, there's Suzanne.
Good girl.
Good
morning.
How are you?
Thank you so much for doing that.
We're here to see that spot, learn more about the case, and do some searching for more evidence. On this mild August day in 2021, we're joined by Suzanne Timms, who, as you may recall, is Patty and Ralph Otto's daughter. She changed her name from Dallas to Suzanne when her Aunt Marcy adopted her and her sister Natalie. Suzanne believes the Jane Doe the hunters found more than 40 years ago could have been her mom.
Okay, all right. We've been waiting a long time for this, guys.
Yes.
This is big. It's exciting. We're going to bring back some good news today. So we're going to bring back some good news. Let's do this.
We'll introduce you to other members of this group as you hear their voices. From the meeting point in town, we all followed a rural road past fields and acres of farms. This is the type of land that looks like a patchwork quilt if you look at it from a satellite view. The first leg of the drive was punctuated by abrupt 90-degree turns as Somerville Road and Dry Creek Lane traced the edges of crop-rich fields. At Craig Loop, we ran out of pavement. From there, our tires followed shallow ruts in the dirt and gravel.
Do we have any idea what this mountain is called? I don't.
When we finally reached Ruckel Road, we turned right and headed farther north, past Jack, Colt, and Moonshine Canyons, slowly ascending into the mountains.
I'm gonna pull up a map on my phone and see if it, there's no service. Yeah, and that's what the
chalky road that took us up here was originally the Thomas and Ruckel Toll Road for horse-led wagons. Over the past century and a half, the road has been trekked by bandits, loggers, day trippers, hunters, and hippies. As the road gradually narrowed, we occasionally had to make way for another vehicle to pass. At times, tree branches scraped against our car. The road was washed out by mudslides in the past, but the gravel is still in relatively good shape, with just a few ruts and deeper dips here and there. By the time we stopped, the trees looked as tall as skyscrapers. We parked and walked a few yards toward a small clearing on our left.
But what we have to remember is we're looking at 40 years of growth here.
Right.
I would bet that if we uncovered all that brush, we'd find a fire pit.
Okay.
Because that's where everybody hung out. And back then, you could see that whole ridge. You know, those trees weren't, you know, nearly as tall as they are now.
Okay.
And this was definitely the spot.
That's Rob Parr talking. He was only 8 years old in 1978 when his dad and a buddy took their sons with them for a big game hunt. The elk population around the Blue Mountains of eastern Oregon was thriving back then, and hunters from surrounding states flocked to the area. The clearing we were standing in had held campsites for several hunters, and it was still only archery season. Rob and his dad were only about 30 miles from their home, but in terrain like this, driving 30 miles takes well over an hour. Camping overnight is not only practical, it's part of the experience.
So, and where we found the skeleton is just up, there's kind of a little ridge right here. It kind of goes up and then back down before it heads up that hill. And it was right up there alongside right on that ridge. You'll see it when we go down there. We go down through this creek we just followed up. And it's just right down through the other creek on a game trail. And that game trail is still there. So, you know how animals are. They're creatures of habit.
Right.
And so...
The son of the other adult hunter in their party was the first to stumble across the woman's remains. Large groupings of bones appeared to have been dug up by animals and were lying on the trail in front of him.
When we came back up and found it, you know, because it was initially found, and then, you know, the kid didn't know where it was, and so everybody came up looking. And I remember my dad and I, we were done. We couldn't find it. Everybody's calling it quits, and we were headed back. And we were coming from this direction down the trail, and bam, there it was. But I vividly remember the skull, the boots, in between the skull and a rib cage. I can see it plain as day.
We followed Rob up the same path law enforcement took as they responded to the scene in 1978.
And I'm not a detective, but this area, just the way the grasses kind of look down there and the way this ground looks right here, there's really no reason for this pile of dirt here. And there's an indentation there.
Mm-hmm.
And because I remember, you know, as the coroners were going through and sifting,
yeah,
you know, they left a pile of dirt on each side of, they never backfilled it.
Well, yeah, where would they?
The woman's voice you hear is Melinda Jetterberg, a volunteer investigator who has been working since 2019 to try to help the Jane Doe reclaim her identity. She and other volunteers formed the Findlay Creek Jane Doe Task Force. Here's Rob Parr again, talking about watching the investigators search for evidence in the shallow grave.
I'm not saying this is the spot, but I know we're really, really close, because as a kid, you know, being a curious 8-year-old kid, I would sneak away, you know, because I wasn't old enough to hunt with my dad when they go out in these big hunts mm-hmm. in the mornings. And I would sneak away from camp and come up here and watch.
Oh, wow.
You know, just as a curious kid. And I remember watching them. I remember there was two of them. I remember they had their little screens out and they were just sifting away through the dirt.
Wow.
But Suzanne, you're really close right here. I know you are.
Investigators worked for days at the site, taking photos, documenting locations of every bone and scrap of cloth, sifting through dirt for tiny remnants of bone and slowly bringing everything they could find out of the shallow grave. The grave appeared to be a little more than 2 feet deep. It was 20 inches wide and 4 feet long. A cable, possibly from a CB radio or a high-end stereo, and pieces of a nylon cord were buried with the bones. There were no obvious signs of trauma on the remains, which appeared to have been in the ground for anywhere from 2 to 5 years. The investigators recovered a pair of red pants, Catalina brand, juniors size 15, ladies size 16. The length had been altered. They also found some zippers and what appeared to have once been white cloth, possibly from a halter top. The clothing all appeared to be consistent with someone who was dressed for warm weather. All except for a pair of ankle-high lace-up boots. The woman had light brown or blonde hair and appeared to be in her early 20s. The medical examiner estimated that she stood between 5'1" and 5'4" tall and had a slight build, weighing anywhere from 115 to 140 pounds. The crews working at the crime scene were not able to find the entire skeleton. Portions of her right arm and hand were missing. The bones were probably carried away by animals. Before our team went to the site, Suzanne arranged to have a canine handler meet us there with a dog to see if anything else could be sniffed out.
Are you having fun, Brynn?
Like, oh my gosh.
Even after 40 years, finding just a tooth is not an impossible task for a well-trained search dog. Amity Larson, who is with us today, is a nationally certified search and rescue canine handler who also raises, trains, and sometimes breeds German Shepherds for this type of work. As Rob showed us the spot where he remembers seeing the grave, Amity and her dog Bryn worked the hill in a meticulous pattern, sweeping back and forth across the slope. Sometimes the dog ran up the hill, but Bryn seemed most interested in areas below where the grave had been.
So we've been in both of those areas several times, and it's like she kind of checks but moves down. But if we take that all into account, yep.
Water runs down.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. So everything runs down. So it would be different if we had someone buried there, because she probably still would pick up odor down because of water going down through, you know, hydraulics and stuff going down through. But she would be more inclined to be like, though there's something here and it's here and here's the box that you're going to find it in. And when we've worked graves where I know that, you know, the body is in that grave, she's done that. She's worked the edges of the grave. Matter of fact, she's more likely to alert on the edge of a grave than on top of it. So, because that's where most of the odor's escaping, is from the edge of it.
As we watched Amity and Bryn work, several of us gathered and chatted on the slope above the grave. Suzanne sat down on the ground to rest. The search dog ran up and laid down next to Suzanne, something it's trained to do when it finds something. No one said a word.
I think my heart about stopped.
Yeah, and twice.
What does that mean?
When the dog sits down, that's the sign to say,
lay down.
Lay down.
Lay
is
down.
The sign.
Is the same.
Lay down.
She did lay down once.
She laid down. Right.
That means she found something. This is it. But they were explaining, she thinks, she's also trained to search for an injured hiker. So Suzanne is sitting down. She may have said, I found somebody.
Everyone else was standing at the time. Yeah. Suzanne was the only one sitting.
I found her. She's the injured one.
You are injured.
I am injured. I think I smell like injury.
That other voice you heard was Jennifer Harrington, Suzanne's cousin. She has helped tremendously with the research for this case, helping to track down documents and witnesses. After Bryn laid down next to Suzanne, Amity called her back to work, saying, "That's not your person." Melinda, the researcher, and Rob talked about some of the early theories about who the Jane Doe could be.
Also on Craig Loop, there was a woman named Bert Metcalf who lived there, and she and her family were really familiar with this area. They hunted here too. So I came here with her and her son as well, and we wandered around up here a little bit. I've just never been able to zero in on the exact area, so I'm hoping I can.
Well, and maybe you'll know, but I just remember, you know, everybody was speculating back at the time that there used to be, in the late 60s and early 70s, there was a hippies camp somewhere up here. And like, and I mean, when I was a kid, I remember, because they had a bunch of garbage. They had like their own their own garbage to dump over there. And being an 8-year-old kid, I was over there crawling through their garbage, you know. And I think it was right a little bit down the creek from here. Yep. And so people were speculating at the time that, you know, it was a hippies had, it was a hippie kill, basically.
Yeah.
That was the speculation that I remember them talking about at the time.
Yeah, I heard that rumor as well. I had two different women who lived on Craig Loop at the time call me after the newspaper article came out last year saying that they remembered two women who had been up here, and they just saw them walking and they thought they were squatting. I don't know if you guys saw me point out the window at Stanley Cabin back there. Mm-hmm. They think that they were squatting there. If you go down there, there's not much down there now, but there's also, when you go back a little ways, you can see the base of another cabin that used to be there. So, you know, there's anywhere that they could have been staying up here.
We called Bertha Metcalf to try to get more details about what she remembers.
Hello?
Hi, is this Bertha?
Yes. I can tell you everything I know.
Okay. From what I understand, you recall seeing two women who were wandering the roads around the time that the body was found?
Yes, my husband and I was working out front in the yard, and we saw these two young girls walk by the house. And I'm trying to think if she had red pants on or checks or something. I can't remember. But they just was walking by, and we said hi. They said hi, and they kept on going. And we watched them turn off Craig Loop and go up Bruckle. And that's all we saw.
And did either of them seem to be in distress?
No, they did not.
Do you feel like one of the women you saw is the body that was later found?
I'm thinking it was.
Okay.
Because she was the smaller of the two. And what puzzles me is, what happened to the other woman?
Right. Right.
And, yeah, were they followed?
Hmm. Yeah.
I mean, you know, I worked for the police department for 10 years, and I do have all these questions, and Dale Mammon and I have discussed this. And so I don't know, I have a lot of questions.
Dale Mammon was the district attorney for Union County back in the 70s. Later, you're going to hear his recollections of going to the site and seeing the grave.
So what other questions do you have?
Maybe it was a guy dressed up like a girl. I don't know.
Yeah.
But what happened to her or him, and how was this lady killed? I would be taking up like an archaeology dig, and I would try and find some bones left over, because surely to God they didn't get all them bones. And with DNA today, you know.
Bertha put us in touch with her son, Kit. He didn't have much to add to what his mother already told us, but we wanted to ask him if it seemed reasonable that someone from Lewiston, Idaho might go to the area to hunt.
Idaho probably would have had good hunting, but, I mean, we had people from Texas everywhere. So there could have been people from Lewiston.
The Lewiston angle felt like a reach, but we were really curious if it's plausible to think that Ralph could have come all the way to this spot to bury his wife. If so, to get here from Lewiston, Idaho, he probably would have gone across the Snake River into Washington and taken Highway 129 down through Asotin and into the hills and gulches of southeast Washington and northeast Oregon. We drove it just to see what the drive would be like, and it was quite the experience. While you navigate switchback turns, winding up and down steep canyons, in particular the Grand Ronde River Canyon, you have to be alert for wildlife, which there's plenty of, right in the middle of the road. Be ready to brake at any moment. All told, it took us more than 3 hours to make the drive one way, and we were doing it in the daylight and on a paved surface. Back in 1976, this highway only had gravel in some spots, and the guardrails that gave us a modicum of security hadn't yet been installed. We didn't even want to imagine making that drive while drunk, sleepy, or high on drugs. Randy Benton, the man Ralph wanted to kill because of a brief relationship with Patty, had made that drive often when he was playing gigs with his band.
When we played for the Joseph Rodeo?
Uh-huh.
I drove that road, and I dated a girl in there, Joseph.
As the crow flies, Joseph, Oregon, is about 40 miles southeast of the spot where the Jane Doe was found.
And we finally decided we better get married or it was going to kill him, driving that road. But, I've driven that road, I don't know, 500 times.
It's a scary road. We drove it just yesterday. And I just can't imagine
doing it. We did.
Yeah. I can't imagine doing it drunk.
Well, I can't now either, you know. But when you're 21 and bulletproof, you can do anything. I'm not saying I always drove it drunk because I didn't. I have driven it after drinking a few. It used to be way different than it is now. The gravel was almost all of, you remember all them curves?
Yes.
Going down in there?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that used to be gravel.
Oh, man. That would be terrifying.
Yeah, I could tell you. Yeah, we used to see bear and mountain lion and, you know, everything on that road. I could probably tell you some stories about that road, but.
Were there railings?
Yeah, it's treacherous in the wintertime.
Oh, I can imagine. Were there railings everywhere when you were driving it back then?
You mean guardrail?
Yeah.
No. And right at the bottom, it just washed out last year. So that's a new bridge.
This all just reinforces our thinking that if the Jane Doe is indeed Patty Otto, and Ralph brought her here, he had to have had help. But was this woman Patty? Patty Otto had blonde hair, was 24 years old, 5'3", and about 140 pounds. She was last seen wearing red pants and a white blouse. Everything about her seemed to be a remarkably close match to the Jane Doe, except for something else found in the grave that we haven't told you about. A fetus, estimated to have been from the third trimester of pregnancy. When we first talked to Suzanne in early summer 2021, she had just recently seen the composite drawing a forensic artist made of what the Jane Doe probably looked like.
So nobody in my family, they're all saying, Suzanne, I see kind of a resemblance, but there's no way that's your mom. We would have known she's pregnant. There's no way she could have hid that.
Suzanne believes her mom could have easily hidden a pregnancy, especially because Suzanne herself didn't look pregnant when she delivered one of her own babies. And if Patty had mixed feelings about getting pregnant while she and Ralph were having marital problems, she might have tried to hide her pregnancy for as long as possible. The medical examiner's report doesn't indicate that any of the clothing found at the scene was maternity style. That tells us that the woman may not have developed a visible baby bump yet. The pants she was wearing were from a line of sportswear that was often made with stretchy polyester. Because more than one person told us that Patty struggled with her weight, we wonder, could it be because she was carrying a baby?
did she find out she was pregnant, reconcile with my dad? And then it's like, hey, I need to tell you, I'm pregnant. It may or may not be your baby, but her whole family insists, no way, she was not pregnant. It's impossible.
Nevertheless, on September 1st, 1978, exactly 2 years after Patty vanished, her parents flew with Tom Saline to a crime lab in Pendleton, Oregon, to look at the clothes found at the scene. When the O'Malleys saw the clothing taken to the lab, they said they didn't think it was what Patty had been wearing when she vanished. None of the reports from Patty's disappearance described her blouse as a halter top. And the ankle-high boots found at the scene looked more like men's work boots than the fashionable shoes Patty would have worn. Just to be clear, the boots weren't simply thrown into the grave with the woman. They were on her feet when she was buried. But there's no record to indicate the size of the boots. Maybe they weren't hers. Maybe her killer put them on her feet. All we can do is speculate. The Oregon State Medical Examiner also compared Patty's dental records to the jawbones recovered at the scene and said they didn't match. He wrote in his notes that the Jane Doe found near Ruckel Road had a number of fillings that didn't match Patty's most recent dental x-rays. He also noted that one of the Jane Doe's wisdom teeth was missing, but three others looked normal. However, in a memo the medical examiner wrote to one of the Oregon investigators explaining the comparison, he cited contradictory details. The memo said the Jane Doe was missing three wisdom teeth, with one remaining maxillary molar. After seeing the composite drawing of what the Jane Doe probably looked like, Suzanne looked at actual photos of the Jane Doe's remains, particularly her skull, and became convinced that the unidentified woman is her mother. She talked to her own dentist to get his opinion. When she handed her mother's x-ray film to the dentist, he remarked that the copy had been printed on the wrong side of the film. No one had noticed the error before, because auto, the most identifiable word on the x-ray, is a palindrome. The letters are in the same order, even if they're written backward. He pointed to a letter in the corner of the film that indicates right and left. It was backward. That could explain why the fillings in her x-ray didn't match those of the Jane Doe. They appeared to be on the wrong side of the jaw.
So I start getting dental records, pictures of my mom, comparing the pictures. I'm taking the teeth in those photos and I'm tracing them, and I have her x-ray and I'm tracing them. This is my mother. But nobody's gonna believe me because it sounds too crazy. So I'm calling the police department to have them send dental records to Oregon. I want her compared again. This is my mother, I can tell. I'm a nurse, not an odontologist, but I can tell these teeth belong to this body. I can see every variance in the teeth in the skeletal photos.
The current Oregon State forensic anthropologist looked at the photos of the Jane Doe and digital images of Patty's x-rays and said she can't draw any conclusions based on the images alone. And she can't compare Patty's x-rays to x-rays taken of the Jane Doe's skull and teeth because they're missing. Along with all the remains and evidence from the scene. After the medical examiner documented details of the case in 1978, the Jane Doe's remains were sent to a funeral home for storage until a positive identification could be made. 12 years later, with the case still unsolved, the only evidence that might give us a clue about her identity was destroyed, and the Jane Doe and her unborn baby's skeletal remains were sent to a crematorium. In an upcoming episode, we'll talk more about how all this unfolded. But you should know that after the cremation, even the cremated remains were lost. The paper trail of who had custody of the cremains went cold.
Now she's missing again? Missing twice. There's your podcast title.
Yeah.
How do you vanish twice?
Missing twice. Yeah.
We talked to Dale Mammon, who was the Union County District Attorney back in 1978. He went to the scene after the Jane Doe was found and watched over some of the work being done to unearth her.
From what I understand, the remains and any evidence that may have been found with her were later destroyed. Is that something that is typical?
No. Not in my opinion.
Okay.
I know sometimes, you know, that they get misplaced or get put on a shelf, but not destroyed, especially with something like this. So, yeah. Now, that's a rather unusual phenomenon that we find us in.
Has this case just stayed with you over the years?
Well, it's one that you remember more than the others. It's so many unknowns, so many, somebody's daughter was there. Somebody's grandchild was there.
Mammon had not heard of the Patty Otto case until we told him about it.
Well, and you know, that's interesting because Lewiston is a back road from where this is. In Northeast Oregon, there's one road that goes to Lewiston.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody were to get out of Lewiston and they would come into Enterprise and then on over towards the Grand Ronde Valley, there's a couple of really old cabins or remnants of cabins on this area. So it's been an area of access for probably 150 years. But I don't know if, you know, somebody were driving down one of the main cross mountain roads and said, oh, here's an old road. Let me just take it and see where it goes. If they were going up the road to the northerly direction, it would be within a couple of miles of basically civilization, farming area. If they were coming from the other direction, from the north, from the Elgin-Weston Highway, they'd say, whoops, I'm almost out of the mountains. I better do something. So it was clearly not a place close to a home where, you know, somebody could have taken somebody, but there were no other reported deaths in the area.
The Weston Elgin Highway Mammon is referring to is a curvy two-lane highway that takes drivers between the Oregon towns of Weston and Elgin. Weston is northwest of the site of the Jane Doe's remains, and Elgin is a short distance southeast of the spot. To approach this site from the north, as Rob and his dad did back in 1978, you'd leave the highway just south of the Andes Prairie Snow Park and take a winding forest service road along miles of mountain ridges before reaching Ruckel Road. It's another 4 miles or so down Ruckel Road before reaching their campsite. To go the way Rob and his dad drove into the site back in 1978, it would be a shot in the dark to find that spot if you didn't know what you were doing. We explained to Mammon that Patty didn't appear to be pregnant when she disappeared in 1976. In his mind, that doesn't rule her out as being the woman found in these hills.
Many times, not many, but sometimes people, and we generically termed it a full term. Now, you know, that could have been anywhere from 3 or 4 months up to, a skeleton.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly wasn't scientific that it was a full-term pregnancy. It just, the lay people there said, you know, there was evidence of a fetus.
Right.
So that element does not bother me at all. Interesting. What happened to the husband? Any idea?
next time on Still.
But we had to actually remove him, physically remove him from the area, because he wouldn't stop working to locate the source of the smell.
Anyone with information pertaining to the disappearance of Patricia Otto should contact the Lewiston Police Department's tip line at 208-298-3939. Anyone with information pertaining to the identity of the Findlay Creek Jane Doe or other information related to that case should contact the Union County District Attorney at da@union-county.org. If you or anyone you know is a victim of domestic abuse, please contact the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 800-799-SAFE. Still is a production of The Reporter's Notebook and Grayson Shaw Media. You can connect with us online at thereportersnotebook.com or via email at info@thereportersnotebook.com. Still was researched, written, and produced by Karen Shaw Anderson. Additional research and script editing provided by Christine Hughes. Original music by Smith Uoso. I'm your host and associate producer, Gary Anderson. Special thanks to everyone who graciously provided interviews and helped with our research. We would specifically like to thank the Advocates for Patricia Otto and the Findlay Creek Jane Doe Task Force. Like, follow, and subscribe to Still on your favorite podcast platform. And follow us on Facebook or Twitter to join the conversation. Ezekiel 34:16. I will seek the lost, and I will bring back the strayed, and I will bind up the injured, and I will strengthen the weak.